This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast. This is an extended edition of the original Radio 4 broadcast. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is Bruce Springsteen, the bard of blue-collar America. For over 40 years, he's been capturing in music and words and performance the defining truth of lives as they're lived in factories and diners, dive bars and schoolyards, chronicling in his own words the distance between the American reality and the American dream. His 20 Grammys, 2 Golden Globes and an Academy Award are pretty much shorthand for not just sales, but the significant cultural mark his music has made. And he couldn't surely have done it so well if he hadn't lived the story himself. Born in New Jersey at the tail end of the 40s, he was brought up in a household often beset by poverty and emotional chaos. He says, "I believe every artist had someone who told them they weren't worth dirt and someone who told them they were the second coming of the baby Jesus, and they believed them both. And that's the fuel that starts the fire." And so welcome, Bruce Springsteen, the fuel that starts the fire. Who were the two people in your life that were telling you those two things?
It's usually your parents.
And it was for you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Obviously, your mother's telling you the second coming of the baby Jesus. And your father holds down the other part of the role.
I'm meeting you at a fascinating time, it strikes me, because you've just finished a massive tour. You've written your memoir. The book is called Born to Run. That's a song you wrote when you were, I think, just 24. As I understand it, it's always on the set list. You play it at every gig still.
It is.
It couldn't not be. There would be a revolt, I imagine. What does it mean to you now?
It takes you back. It takes you forward. You know, a good song takes you in all those different directions, I think. Jackson Brown would say, well, the nice thing about good songs is they stay written. And not only do they stay written, but they live. They live the years with you. You sort of take the measure of your moment at night when you play that song. And I suppose the show builds to it. It's a cathartic moment. And it's still something I find a lot of satisfaction in playing.
Tell me a bit about this list of 8 tracks that you've chosen then. What was your basis for choosing them?
It's not an unusual grouping of songs. It's songs that a lot of people are going to be familiar with and that affected, I'm sure, many others. But I chose it because this was the music that electrified me, that when I heard them for one reason or another, they just galvanized me into changing my life in some way.
Tell me about the first track then.
Okay, that's Hound Dog, Elvis Presley. If I had to choose an album, I'd probably choose the Sun Sessions. That's probably my favorite Elvis music. But for a single track, which is the first Elvis song I ever heard, that when I was relatively young, probably 7 years old or something, when I heard it, it just shot straight through to my brain. And I realized suddenly that there was more to life than what I'd been living, you know. And immediately went out, rented a guitar, tried to play the thing, couldn't quite get to playing it. But I was then in pursuit of something, and there had been a vision laid out before me. It was just an incredibly meaningful record. Elvis was considered a novelty act. He wasn't deemed to have a lot of cultural significance initially at all. So you were just dealing with the pure thrust, the pure energy of the music itself. And it's funny because I was so very young, but it still hit me like a thunderbolt and still sounds great to this day. We still base our snare drum sound. One of the ultimate snare drum sounds is on Hound Dog. It's a beautiful, beautiful sounding record. And of course, Elvis sings it fabulously.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, girl, you're crying all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, girl, crying all the time.
was Elvis and Hound Dog. Bruce Springsteen, you started life then, as the world knows, in New Jersey. You were in this little sort of L-shaped enclave. You lived with your grandparents and surrounded by aunts and uncles. Mm-hmm. What are your earliest memories of that time?
It's always the church, the church, the church, I think, because it was the center of our existence. I think the thing I remember most is just the tall steeple at the end of the corner and the red bricks of the church. It was your second home. You lived there, you know, every Sunday and Friday, and we saw every wedding, every funeral in town because we lived next door. So it was, there was always a show going on. Somebody was always either getting married or getting dead. So it was an enormous center of my childhood life.
And of course, this would have been the early 50s, and it sounds, you know, this little L-shaped grouping of houses, the church just across the yard, that can all sound idyllic, but notably, you do say of your childhood, you grew up surrounded by very ill, secretive people with disturbing, unpredictable behaviors.
Yes.
Tell me more.
There was just a lot of illness that ran through my family on the Irish side particularly, but even somewhat on the Italians also. I mean, when you're young, you don't think anything about it very much.
And their behavior might be what?
Depression and a mental illness that just swept through my family and kind of gets passed on down.
And so an intriguing counterbalance to this is your mother, Adele. Tell me more about her.
Yeah, my mom and her sisters. There were three Italian sisters. Endless optimism was a part of who they were. And no matter how hard life got, that was always there. They always decided that life was worth living. They just insisted on the fact that life would be good, no matter what curves it threw at you. And this is what they brought into my life and my sister's life for my entire childhood, no matter how strange or how rough things got. They were this sort of World War II generation, never say die, insisted on joy and beauty.
What did your dad do for a living as you were growing up?
Well, he did a lot of different things. You know, he worked on the line at the Ford Motor Plant. He worked as a guard at the jail for a short period of time. He worked in a plastics factory. He drove a taxi. He did a lot of different things.
And your grandmother on your father's side, she ceaselessly indulged you. You were more than the apple of her eye. Just explain the circumstances of that.
What can you say? The circumstances were unusual. She'd had a young child who died in a traffic accident around the corner from our home. She was only 5 years old. It was my father's sister. And so it put her in bed for several years, and it was a very damaging part of her life that she never really forgot. So when I came along, I was sort of the first new child in the family since that had happened, and it gave me quite a bit of license.
What did she let you away with?
I was doing a lot of strange things when I was a young kid. I was staying up till 3 a.m. and waking up at 3 p.m. in the afternoon. And
so that was like a proto rock and roller. You were there already.
I always say that it's very strange the way the choices you make play out. I always say that I went to school, which I hated, but in the minute I got out of school, I found a job where I'm up till 3 a.m. and I sleep till 3 p.m., so couldn't have been a coincidence.
No. Tell me about your second piece of music, Bruce Springsteen. What are we going to hear?
It's I Want to Hold Your Hand by the Beatles. This was another song that just changed the course of my life. The harmonies were very unusual. It was a very raucous-sounding record when it came out of the radio in 1964. And once again, I went for another shot at the guitar. And this time I kept playing it. And it was really the song that inspired me to play rock and roll music, to get in a small band and to start doing some small gigs around town. But it was a life-changing, it's still a beautiful record, the way it sounds. And it was just a life-changing piece of music.
Oh yeah, I'll tell you something I think you'll understand. When I say that something, I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand. Oh please, say to me,
to me. You let me hold your hand. I let me hold your hand.
That was the Beatles and I Want to Hold Your Hand. Bruce Springsteen, I'm delighted and not a little bit surprised to learn that you were a regular at the Friday night soirees of the Young Men's Christian Association, that you were dancing the monkey, the swim, the jerk, the pony, the mashed potatoes. I'm not going to ask you to do them now. How did you learn the dances and what did you look like?
Oh, man. I'm sure a complete fool. But before I could play the guitar, I realized that girls love to dance. And so I'd spent quite a bit of time in my own home mirror practicing all the different dance moves of the day.
Were you good?
I don't know. It was good enough to get the girls on the dance floor.
Glad to hear it. And what about the hair? How did you look in those days?
Pretty hideous. Let me see. I would use my mother's hair clips to pin my hair down, and then I would sleep on it exactly right on the pillow because I had Italian curly hair when I had more hair. But I would pin it down till it was the straightest Brian Jones, and then I would go to the Y. So there was a complete presentation that I got ready for on Friday night. My black chinos, my black shoes, the pointy toes, red socks, red shirt, and my hair just so, and off I'd go.
You've, of course, played these legendary stadium gigs in front of tens of thousands of people. You have played at the Super Bowl in the intermission in front of, I imagine, tens of millions of people of a live TV audience. But your first ever live performance on stage was at the Freehold Elks Club. What can you remember? How old were you?
I was probably maybe 15.
What was your set?
We had a bit of a Stonesy playlist. We played a lot of R&B, some blues. And the big capper was at the end of the night, I would sing Twist and Shout, because it was still the day when there weren't many groups with singers. The invention of the group that sang everything, wrote everything, and played everything, of course, was the Beatles. But before that, all local bands were instrumental. They played based on, like, the Shadows, and in the States it was the Ventures. So you'd come to a dance at night, and there were no microphones. A band would simply set their amps up, play instrumentals all night long. No one would sing. And our idea was we were going to be one of the first groups in town that tried to sing. And so, really, we had no voices, but we gave it a shot. And that was our calling card. Too often, disastrous results, but...
Did you feel at home on stage from the very beginning?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I was nervous when I first started, but at the same time, it was a very singular place, and I was seeking that out, you know, some place that was going to cut me out as different.
Because that sort of confirmed that you were different. You felt yourself to be
different. Yeah, yeah. I suppose everyone feels like that. But I was looking for some place to express it. And so getting up to that mic and doing whatever I did into it at the time, it was exciting and I always felt good afterwards.
Let's hear your next piece of music. What are we going to hear now?
This is It's All Over Now by the Rolling Stones. I suppose the penultimate song for me for the Rolling Stones is still Satisfaction. That was the song that solidified the Stones in our neighborhood as real competition with the Beatles, you know. But It's All Over Now held a special place for me because when I got thrown out of my first band, I learned the guitar solo. I went home that night and I was pissed off and I went in my room and I said, all right, I'm going to be a lead guitar player. And for some reason, that solo felt like something I might be able to manage. And so I put the record on, and I sat there all night until I was able to scrape up some relatively decent version of Keith's solo on It's All Over Now. That, and also, once again, it's a great-sounding record, the echo and the way the two guitars blend and mix. And there's a little country influence in it also, which I always liked coming out of the Stones. Mixing's it great, but it was once a very important record for me because it was the first solo I ever learned to play.
bed. When I got worried, she eased my aching head. Well, now she's here and there. Well, every man in town still trying to take me for that same.
That was the Rolling Stones, and it's all over now. You've written, Bruce Springsteen, that throughout your teens, talking about your father, you said, when my dad looked at me, he didn't see what he needed to see. And then a little later, he loved me, but he couldn't stand me. Those are very powerful words. Explain the background to those words. Why do you think your father felt the way he felt?
It was just the lay of the land in our household at the time. You know, it was... My dad had a sort of gruff exterior, but inside he was really, he could be quite soft and sensitive. And the qualities he had inside were the things I wore on the outside. And they were just difficult for him to deal with, you know.
So in seeing your sensitivity, it reminded him of the things that he was trying to...
Yeah, it might have reminded him of his own frailties in some way, or fragility. So it was just a... terrible cross current of emotion that went on between us. You know, we sorted through some of it as he got older and as I got older, but it was sad when I was young.
We live in a time now, of course, when people talk within families. People talk about their feelings. It wasn't that way in the 50s and 60s. It was a very, very different culture within the family. You've spoken about this extremely loving, optimistic mother that you had. Did you talk to her about your dad at the time? Because I'm sure you couldn't talk to him.
No. I don't remember. I mean, she would occasionally, she would cover for him, but it's very hard to explain today. But at the time, people simply didn't speak about their inner feelings. You didn't even think about speaking about it. It wasn't on the table at all. So you just sort of lived with it. I think, you know, my mother tried to make up for it as best as she could through giving us a lot of love and a lot of affection. She was very physical and very warm. She was a very warm person. And so, you know, you learned the other side through what you were seeing, which is the way kids basically learn anyway. I mean, there's a small percentage of what you say, I think, that registers on them. But at the end of the day, they do what they've seen. And... So my mother tried to balance that out and as best as she could.
You were making your way, you say you were thrown out of one group, but you went on to have another small group and you began to make your way in your musical career. There came a very pivotal moment when you met John Landau. You've had this 40-year, both professional association and also very close friendship. There was a moment when he went to see you as a music producer. It's gone now in legend now. The review he wrote of the gig in Boston, and he penned the line, "I saw Rock and Roll Future, and its name is Bruce Springsteen." When you first met him after he'd written it, aside from the flattery, what was it that meant that you got on with each other? Why did you click?
When I first met him, I don't think he'd written...
Oh, really?
He hadn't written that piece yet, but he'd written a small review that was tacked up outside of the club we were playing, trying to get some breathing customers in for the night, you know. We were playing a little club in Boston. There was about 8 or 9 people in it. The little review was tacked on the glass window outside. And it was in wintertime, and I was standing out in the cold with my jacket wrapped up around me reading this little review. And at that exact moment, along came two guys. One was John Landau, and the other one was David Marsh. And they said, "Hi." I said, "Hi." You know, they said, "What do you think?" I said, "Well, that's pretty good." And he introduced himself as the guy who had written the review, and I met Dave. They came in and saw the show that night. And we struck up sort of a modest friendship. But there was a show at, I think, called Harvard Square Theater where John saw us and wrote that particular piece a little bit later on. But it's followed me around quite a bit since then.
Do you like it or does it irk you? I mean, it's quite the proclamation, isn't it?
Yeah, that's for sure. Initially, it was a little difficult, but I mean, looking back, it's all funny now.
You went on to collaborate with him, of course, on Born to Run, and you've said of that, You wanted to pen a record like the last record you might hear, the last one you'd ever need to hear.
Yeah.
That's quite an ambition for a young man.
Well, let me see. I was 24, and I was an ambitious young man. I was.
Clearly, but also you must have thought you could write that song.
I guess I did. And, I'd had a lot of experience before then. I'd been playing for 10 years.
Yes.
And I'd experienced just about every sort of gig you can imagine. You know, we played supermarket openings, drive-in theaters, firemen's fairs, VFW halls, weddings. I'd played in front of every conceivable audience you could imagine. And I'd drawn thousands of people to my shows at that point. And it was a band I had called Steel Mill. We drew thousands of people without a record to our local shows. So I knew what having some success was. I traveled around the country already. I'd been back and forth across the United States several times. Traveled to San Francisco with one of my bands. Competed in that area where there were a lot of good musicians in those days. And we held our own pretty well. So I'd seen a lot. And I felt like, well, I've been around a bit, I've seen a lot, and I still felt, well, I think I'm one of the most distinctive musicians I've seen at my age. And so I had a lot of confidence. And I had a certain vision. I wasn't so much a revolutionary as I was an alchemist, you know. When we went to do Born to Run, I mean, I had Duane Eddy in my head, Roy Orbison, great Phil Spector records, Dylan, the physicality of Elvis. I said, somehow I'm going to mix all these things together, and I want to make the greatest record anyone's ever heard, you know.
Tell me about your next piece of music, then. This is your fourth disc.
Madame George, Van Morrison, Astral Weeks, extremely important record for me and a lot of other people. It made me trust in beauty. It gave me a sense of the divine. The divine seems to just run through the veins of that entire album. So there was a spiritual side of it that was very, very deep. Of course, it was incredible singing, playing of Richard Davis on the bass. It had the jazz influences. And it was trance music. You know, it was repetitive. It was the same chord progression, three chords over and over again. But it showed how expansive something with very basic symbol underpinning could be. So there'd be no New York City Serenade if there hadn't been Astral Weeks. And this was, of course, my favorite cut off the entire record.
Yeah, that's sad, the making of the stops. Kids out in the street collecting bottle tops. Gone for cigarettes and matches in the shops. Happy taking Madame Joy. Oh, that's when you fall. Whoa, 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 whoa.
That was Van Morrison and Madame George. You said, going into that Bruce Springsteen, that it taught you, among many other things, to trust in beauty. In 1984, you released what remains, in spite of all your other huge successes, your most successful selling album, Born in the USA, and that iconic image on the cover, the Annie Leibovitz photograph. You said at the time, in the end, that picture was chosen because my ass looked better than the picture of my face, which always makes me smile. But it tells tales of ordinary Americans, of people just grinding out their jobs, of trying to make difficult relationships work, of dealing with being short of money. I mean, that is still what you write about. And yet, the further away you have moved from that in your life, how easy is it to always connect when you go to that place of writing with the ordinary lives of everyday Americans?
Well, you know, you have all of your experience to draw from all the time. So you can always go back and draw on any place you've ever been. In the formative years of your childhood and your young adulthood still remain incredibly powerful, which is why people feel most connected often to the music that they were say, in high school with at a certain moment, or in college or your early 20s. In your formative years, the music that you use to build your identity always remains very prominent in your tastes.
You know, people who have had great pain and difficulty in their childhood, often they often manage to make a success of being an adult by not going there anymore. And yet, in order to write about the things you do, you've always gone back. Was there a price to pay in that, in mining your past for your current creativity, of going back to where you came from?
I think that you work on the thing that's eating away at you. And I think that the performers that we feel are wrestling with something significant are the performers that hold our attention. Why couldn't people take their eyes off Brando? Something was always eating at him. I don't know if it was ever named, but whatever it was, you couldn't take your eyes off him when he came on screen. Why can't you take your eyes off of Dylan? Well, there's something eating at him. So a lot of my work is drawn from the period in my life where I'm trying to go back and make sense of things that at the time were unfathomable and uncontextualizable. And that continues to this day. I constantly go back and I put my father's clothes on and I walk out on stage and I present some version of him and myself at night to my audience. And why am I doing that? Well, I'm trying to find the piece of it that would lead to a certain sort of transcendence over those circumstances that I grew up in. So these are all things I'm working out on stage at night and why people come to see us.
It's clearly worked professionally. Has it worked personally?
Well, generally doesn't work as well personally as professionally. At some point you have to, you address these things and you let a certain amount of them go, and of course you move on, but you're always called back to those moments, and while I don't live in them anymore, I do occasionally revisit them.
I know you didn't have a beer till you were 22. Steve Van Sant says you are the only person he has ever known who has never, ever taken drugs. You operate your band set up in a kind of benign dictatorship. It seems that the control that you've been able to exert personally has also been a very significant part of that. You exerted just untypical in your industry control over how you've behaved.
Yeah, I'm sure too much at times, but I come from a chaotic childhood, I felt. And so what I was interested in doing was creating some order and a safe environment for myself, because my childhood felt very unsafe, and a structure where I can express myself freely and grow into a man, you know. So for me, my first luxuries were a place where I could create some semblance of order out of my life. And I think that explains why I really didn't go into introducing into my system any sort of chemicals that I felt were going to unbalance me. I'd had enough imbalance. So I went in the other direction. And initially I was very tight about it. And then, of course, as you get older, you relax with things. But I did, I didn't really drink a lot until I was a little older than most people. And it was what I was in pursuit of. I was in pursuit of a certain, I wouldn't say tranquility, but certainly a certain order that had been missing from my life when I was young.
Let's have some more music, Bruce Springsteen. Tell me about your next one.
What's Going On, right? Marvin Gaye. First of all, this entire record is, from start to finish, is a masterpiece. It was sultry and very sexual, while at the same time having very political point of view, dealing with street-level politics. That had a big influence on me, along with the idea that it was somewhat of a concept record without being cursed by that name. It was a record that had a thread you could follow from the first song to the last, and it created a world that you could walk into and then come back out of, but bring along with you things you'd learned and energy and a source that you'd found for living. What's Going On was a record that really struck home for me for all those particular points.
War is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and get here today. Picket lines and picket signs, don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh, what's going on? What's going on? What's going on?
That was Marvin Gaye and What's Going
Beautiful.
On.
Beautiful.
Beautiful. It was 1984 then when Patti Scalfa joined the E Street Band, a pivotal time for you. You were, of course, to fall in love, to get married, to have children, but a very significant, I'm sure, part of your relationship has been that you share the music together,
oh,
that
course,
she is
yeah.
too a musician and a performer.
Patti is just a great songwriter and very distinctive and original voice. She gets the show about 1/100th of that on stage with the E Street Band, you know, but she's made 3 very good records. I initially saw her fronting a band in Asbury Park, singing a song by the Exciters called Tellin'. And she just had a sound that sort of was part Dusty Springfield, part the Ronettes and Crystals. It was just a beautiful combination of elements. And then she just had something in it that was her own. And Patti joined the band literally days before we went out on tour in 1984. And then it was years later, we got together as a couple. And it was very interesting. I hadn't been involved with another musician before. And so she had a lot of understanding of where I was coming from and some of the choices I'd make and a little bit about the twisted parts of my personality that she knew how to handle and live with better than some of my other relationships. It was a lovely beginning to what's been a very beautiful relationship.
So you've had 3 children together, Evan, Jessica, and Sam. Tell me about that point in 1990 before the birth of Evan, your first child, where your father got in a car and drove hundreds of miles to come and see you. Why was he doing that and what happened?
Oh, I think it was, I was going to be a father, and I think that he had some things he wanted to say, which was very unusual for my dad, but he must have felt pressed to come down and sort of give me slightly a bit of a warning as to where he felt he went wrong.
What did he say?
Just that he felt he hadn't been present enough for me and hadn't perhaps been as good to me as he might have wanted to be. And it was a very short conversation because my dad's not much of a talker, but it was a pretty meaningful one at the time.
You said, you know, very poignantly, you put on your father's clothes, as it were, to go on stage. You are an amalgam of both yourself and him when you perform. Off stage, becoming a father yourself, what was that transformation like?
T-Bone Burnett had a great quote where he said, all of rock and roll is somebody going, Daddy, wow! So I say, it's certainly true in my case, you know? So it's my indulgence, I guess. But
when you became
becoming
a father,
dad myself was... It was a very different experience, you know. It was, it opens your life and it opens your heart, your mind, your life up to a world that was present, but that previously you had not recognized nor seen. So suddenly you get this beautiful flooding of another vision of life and of what life can be. It surprised me how much I'd missed. And so the child, when they come, you know, there's a little window that opens and they bring in a certain amount of grace with them. And suddenly when that's gifted to you, it changes the way you see everything, the way you write, the way you think. You step outside and you fill your lungs with, it feels like, with more air. It was, has been, and continues to be an incredible thing to experience.
Let's have some more music, Bruce Springsteen. This is Year 6.
Out of Sight. Pure excitement, pure electricity, pure get out of your seat, move your ass, pure sweat-filled, gospel-filled, raw rock and roll rhythm and blues, you know?
You got your highest deacons on, slipping new. You got your highest deacons on, and you're slipping new. You're more than all right, you know you're out of sight. You got a shapely figure, mama, that's keeping you uptight. You got a shapely figure, mama, keep me uptight.
That was James Brown, and
that's fascinating. I haven't heard that in a while. And it's like a taut rubber band. I was surprised at how tight and restrained that record sounds. Very exciting.
You've spent your professional life being a hero on stage to many, many people. Barack Obama said, "I'm only running for president because I can't be Bruce Springsteen." How much are you concerned about being as open as you have been in your memoir, and indeed as you have been occasionally on stage, and certainly in your music, about depression? Because people want to think of you as other than them, and here you are sharing your weakness with everybody.
I didn't think about it that much when I went to write about it. It was just, if you're writing an autobiography, you have to open your life up to a certain degree, and you agree to show them your mind and how it works and how you've made your decisions and the things that have affected you, that have shaped your music. And, you know, I tried to do it as humorously and as discreetly as possible, but it's just something that's been a part of my life. I mean, it was much more difficult for my pop and for a lot of the other members of my family who suffered from it a lot. But I've had to deal with it as time's passed on, and it's usually okay. And then once in a while, Churchill's black dog, you know, jumps up and bites you in the ass for a little while. I've developed some skills that help me dealing with it, but it's still, it's a powerful, powerful thing that really comes up from things that still remain unexplainable to me.
And can I ask you what the skills are? You say you've developed skills to learn that.
Just naming it sometimes, you know, on a particular day, it's a chemical imbalance also. What most people tend to want to do is when they feel bad, the first thing you want to do is name a reason as to why you feel that way. I feel bad because. And you'll transfer that to someone else. Well, because Johnny said this to me, or this happened, or that, you know. And sometimes that's true. But a lot of times, you're simply looking to name something that's not particularly nameable. And if you misname it, it just makes everything that much worse. So I think my skills at sort of saying, okay, it's not this, it's not that, it's just this. This is something that comes. It's also something that goes, you know. It may be something I have to live with for a period of time. But if you can acknowledge it and if you can relax a little bit with it, very often it shortens its duration.
And you said that in recent years, you suffered an episode of depression where you were close to the abyss. You felt closer than you had ever been. That is a very dangerous place to be. What was it that brought you back from that?
Patty is very helpful. And sometimes just time, you know. Or sometimes the correct medication. You need the right drugs. That can really help also. So these are all things that can pull you back into your life. And certainly in my case, how blessed my life's been.
Let's have some more music, Bruce. Tell me about your next one. We're on your penultimate disc, your seventh.
All right, Like a Rolling Stone. This could be at the top of the list. The way I described it, and I think when I inducted Dylan into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And so the snare drum that opens the song feels like somebody kicked open the door to your mind. Like a Rolling Stone is a torrent that comes rushing towards you, floods your soul, floods your mind, alerts and wakes you up instantaneously to other worlds, other lives, other ways of being. You know, it's perhaps one of the most powerful records ever made, and still means a great, great deal to me, along with all of Dylan's work. And this is the first time I heard it, was it came out of the radio. I didn't know anything about Bob Dylan's acoustic music. I was a creature of Top 40, so the first time I really heard him was on the radio with this song, and it just instantly started to change my life, you know. That's ageless.
That was Bob Dylan. How does it feel? The difference then, this is your specialist subject, Bruce Springsteen, the difference between the American dream and the American reality. And your music over the decades has asked those very big questions about what it means to be an American, what it means to be free, what it means to be a man. And you've written landmark albums. The Rising was written in response to 9/11, The Wrecking Ball after the crash of 2008, the financial crash. Do you think rock and roll still has the cultural muscle to reach people now? Do you think it's where we go to understand our experience and hear it meaningfully reflected back at us?
Well, you know, music has gotten very factionalized, so it's very different. One of the most prescient statements on this whole subject was Lester Bangs, one of the great rock critics from the 70s, when Elvis died, said, well, from here on in, I'm going to have my own heroes and you're going to have yours. I may like Iggy Pop, you may like Joni Mitchell, but there's going to be very few things we're ever going to agree to ever again. So instead of saying goodbye to Elvis, I'm going to say goodbye to you. And it was very, very forward-looking. And I think that that's what we've had to deal with as the lay of the land over the past quarter century of pop music. I don't know if there is any one place where people go to hear cultural comment these days. I think you can find it in the super pop and R&B that's on top 40 radio these days. You can find it in a lot of indie music. So rock doesn't have the hegemony that it used to have. Everybody goes to the coal mine and digs as best as they can. But there's also acts that have to behave as if none of the above is true, where you have to go out looking for your biggest audience, an audience that you feel is interested in the times that you're writing about and the form that you're using to communicate your insights, whatever they may be. And that's the way I proceed with my job. I think U2 does something like that. Artists as varied as Kanye West go out and do it, assuming they can speak to everyone at a certain moment. I think that's how I like to approach it these days.
We're going to cast you away to a desert island on this show. You know that. I'm imagining you
really
know that. Yeah. When you get there, you will be all alone. How are you a coper? Are you a guy who can cope? I mean, are you practically minded? Do you think you'll be able to survive?
In some ways, I'm pretty good on my own. On the other hand, I'm not sure I would necessarily be my best company.
Let's have your final piece of music, Bruce Springsteen. What are we going to hear? What's your eights?
Baby, I Need Your Lovin' by the Four Tops. And I had to have some Motown, because Motown was an incredible part of my youth. It was also, if you wanted to know how to write, how to structure successful pop records, you could learn it all from Motown. The sound of the band, the importance of a great singer. Motown was just the school where you wanted to go to learn your craft. And this was a song that every little bar band played, this one back in the day. And along with that, it was just a beautiful piece of music.
Some say it's a sign of weakness for a man.
Baby, I need your loving. Got to have all your loving. Baby,
That was the Four Tops and Baby, I Need Your Loving. So, Bruce Springsteen, it's come to the point in the programme where I give all our castaways a couple of books to take with them, and you get to take to this island the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, and along with those, you get to choose one other book. What is your book going to be?
That was a tough question. I'm a fan of Philip Roth, John Cheever, Jim Thompson, James M. Cain, Flannery O'Connor, all the Russian guys. but if I had to pick a book that sort of changed my way of thinking, it might be Joe Klein's Woody Guthrie biography, Woody Guthrie: A Life. It was a very influential book for me and changed my way of thinking about what you might be able to do with popular music.
Okay, we'll give you that book. You're allowed a luxury, too.
A chef.
I'm afraid it can't be any living being or thing. That's the bad news.
All right,
I can give
right.
you a kitchen.
I have to
can
be alone.
Cook? Can you cook?
A kitchen. What's the good is that going to do me?
Or your guitar. Would you like to take
it? I'd definitely bring the guitar, that's okay. for sure.
Well, it's only one, so you're not getting the kitchen, but you are getting the guitar.
All right.
And if you had to save one of these eight discs from the waves, which single disc would you run to save?
That's really tough. I'd have to say Like a Rolling Stone.
Okay, it's yours. Bruce Springsteen, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island
Thanks
discs.
Thanks a lot. Thank I you. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.
This is the BBC.